Appalachian Words, the show about language in Appalachia and the Great Smoky Mountains. I'm your host, Jennifer Heinmiller. I am co-author of the Dictionary of Smoky Mountain and Southern Appalachian English, a historical dictionary that is over 1.3 million words long and covers all sorts of words from Appalachia, from Adam's house cat to zigaboo to my personal favorite, circumvengimus. If you're curious about any of those, subscribe to the show and tune in. Appalachian English is a rich language with a history stretching back hundreds of years. But outside of the region, there are more stereotypes than honest conversation about the culture. In an effort to bring this language and its history to a wider audience, I decided to start this show. For each episode, I'll be reading and discussing entries in the dictionary and highlighting Appalachian culture and history, as well as talking about how the dictionary is set up and the process of compiling it. I welcome your questions, comments, stories, or any other message you'd like to send to me. Although, as always, keeping it PG would be cool. Welcome back to the mountains and foothills of Appalachia. You are listening to episode 6. I want to start today with a sort of apology for the delay and a huge thank you to those of you who sent messages checking in and inquiring about new episodes. I'm so glad to hear that you're finding this show interesting. I realize I've taken kind of a long hiatus that was unannounced, and I wanted to explain a little bit. So to get a little personal, I've had some pretty big work things pop up out of the blue, which has been good news for me, but has kept me busy, of course. And in addition to that, a member of my family suddenly passed away. And it's always a difficult time of transition when somebody we love passes away. I went through this over the summer as well, when my co-author, Michael Montgomery, got sick and then passed away. You know, I think you'll understand when I say, like, it's just a complex combination of grief and relief that everybody feels if the person was suffering a lot, which in this case, she was suffering a great deal. So my family's just been a bit quiet, and I've taken some time for quiet reflection, just, you know, kind of keeping to myself, haven't really had the energy to do recording, but thank you for bearing with me, and I do hope you'll keep listening. So as far as future episodes, I'm still fairly busy with some work obligations, and with pushing this dictionary towards publication, which is super exciting. Due to that, episodes may be kind of slow to come out and not as consistent as I would like, but I'm working on that, and I'm still planning on producing as many episodes as I can and as quickly as I can. So, on a related note, I have had some very good news from the University of North Carolina Press, who has officially expressed interest in publishing the dictionary. So I'm working with them on details and putting together a timeline for publication. So if you happen to be interested in being a part of the project and you'd like to contribute financially towards publication, please contact the University of North Carolina Press, or you can reach out to me, wrong preposition, and I can put you in touch with the folks who handle that sort of thing. I realize this is kind of a weird thing to put out there, but for a project this big, the budget is pretty high, so any donations to the press would be most welcome. It would help us get this thing on the road to publication. And I just want to say the University of North Carolina Press is run by a great group of people, and they're all passionate about the same things we're passionate about here. So I consider it a huge privilege to work with them on the project. And I also want to add, if you do want to make a financial contribution, anyone who donates $250 or more will receive directly from me a signed copy of the dictionary once it is in hand. So yeah, kind of a fun little bonus there if you're interested. So for today's episode, I would kind of like to take my family's recent experience as an opportunity to explore funeral traditions in Appalachia. And I think it kind of aligns well with the time of year. You know, I like to do these kind of seasonal things. Right now, I think we're 9 days out from Halloween. So pretty seasonally appropriate, I would say. The first term that I want to talk about is Decoration Day, which was kind of a memorial day to one's ancestors or family members who had passed away. So we have a great passage here from a book called Decoration Day in the Mountains. I'm sure, you know, you can probably guess they give quite a bit of detail there. It was written in 2010 by Alex Jabor and Karen Singer Jabor, and I hope I'm not butchering the pronunciation of their name. But this book, it's a really great volume. It was actually published by UNC Press, speaking of the devil. So, little shout out to them. So, they write, Decoration Day is a widespread cultural tradition in a swath of the American South, extending from east of the Appalachians to west and southwest of the Ozarks. In the fullest form of the tradition, people visit a cemetery where family members are buried to provide an annual or periodic cleaning. Then they decorate the graves with flowers and other symbols of affection. Finally, they gather as a family or community in a religious service in the cemetery, reaffirming their connections with each other and with the community beneath the ground. The service may involve preaching, prayers, hymn singing, and a ritual meal known as dinner on the ground. Decoration Day, its practitioners often call the event simply a decoration, is a powerful ritual of piety. At the practical level, it provides a cultural motivation for cleaning and repairing a cemetery, which, if not properly maintained, can be reclaimed by the forest of the upland south with astonishing speed. At the social level, it serves as a focal point for gathering a community, and it has long provided an occasion for community members from afar to return to their home place. At the deepest spiritual level, a decoration is an act of respect for the dead that reaffirms one's bonds with those who have gone before. We have another example here from quite a bit earlier, 1935. So this is a book called Cabins in the Laurel, written by Muriel Shepherd. And full disclosure, this is so funny. This is also a UNC Press book. This is a total coincidence, I promise. I have not become a spokesperson for the press or anything like that. Not opposed to it, but I am not currently. Anyway, among the mountain people, the National Memorial Day passes unnoticed. In its place, each of the country churches has its own decoration when the congregation holds a memorial service for the dead. These individual services, in a long procession from late spring to midsummer, are a timely chance for wide interchurchly visiting. I love that word she uses, interchurchly. That's a word you probably wouldn't see in a typical dictionary, but we know exactly what it means. Isn't it amazing how language works? I just love it. But anyway, this is also a great way to see how they did just call it decoration in many cases. So one more from the Asheville Citizen-Times newspaper, and I'm including this both because it's a great clip and because I like to represent my town. So this is from 1952. A long-standing custom of the mountain people is the annual decoration, held by many families in the spring, at which family cemeteries are given annual cleanings. These decorations are much more than gatherings to place flowers on the graves of the departed. They are great reunions of entire families, often of a whole clan of the same name. Held always in the warmer months of the year, a decoration is usually an all-day affair on a Sunday. People gather early and stay most of the day. Religious services are conducted by as many as 4 or 5 ministers who have served the community. Conducted out of doors, unless interrupted by a summer shower, the settings of these decorations under the clear mountain skies and in surroundings of solid greenery have a peculiar atmosphere that is so easily sacred to all those who take part in them. I think this is such a touching tradition, and it reminds me of something they do in Japan, actually. I've spent a lot of my time in Japan, and I used to live there, so the culture is very close to my heart. They have a similar practice in Japanese culture, in which families clean graves and visit the graves of ancestors to show respect and connect with those who came before them. I really like this aspect of that culture, and it's also cool to me to know that my own ancestors probably did something really similar. These days we hear a lot about like mindfulness and personal improvement and growth, but I also think that things like this are also really grounding and calming. and they really put things into perspective and allow people to express gratitude, you know, to those who brought you to where you are now, whether it's your direct blood relatives or ancestors, or even the people who settled the town you live in. It's just a great way to connect with the extended community, both present and past. So related to this, we have the term funeral. So it's a little bit different. I'll just go right into the definition we have in the dictionary. A funeral, formerly often preached at a memorial service at a time after a person's death and burial, also called preaching funeral. So for me, this contrasts with what I know to be the meaning of funeral, which is usually immediately following someone's death or, you know, like within a week thereafter or so. But in this case, we're talking about an event that takes place sometimes up to years after the fact, which I would probably refer to as a memorial. Although, like thinking about it in my experience, even memorials are usually not that long after the person passes. So this is evidence of another tradition of keeping your ancestors and loved ones in mind and paying respect. And I have a few different examples here, and we'll kind of get into why they might have been so far after the person actually passed away. So the first one is from 1957, Josiah Combs, his book Folk Songs of the Southern United States. He says, "Grave sites are seldom visited except at a burial or at a funeral, which is usually preached many years after the burial." And then from three decades later, 1987, John Irwin, his book The Museum of Appalachia Story. Before I forget, I want to mention here, I'd be remiss if I did not mention, John Irwin actually founded the Museum of Appalachia. So he is the supreme authority on it. He founded it in 1969, and it's up in Clinton, in Tennessee. And it's a nice stop if you're passing through the area or if you want to delve deeper into Appalachian history or culture. They have a nice little gift shop and a restaurant right there on site. So Irwin wrote, "All the Big Valley people, it seemed to me, had said at one time or another, 'I want Uncle John to preach my funeral.'" It's interesting in that example to me, the phrase, "preach my funeral." I think in standard English, we would now say "preach at my funeral." So this is also a great example of some older Appalachian grammar, which I'd love to go into in a future episode, but just a nice little illustration there. We also have the related term funeralize. So this is a verb meaning to hold a funeral service at a later, more convenient date, i.e. after burying a person immediately, of a minister to officiate and preach at such a service. In former times, the service could come weeks or months afterward in order to await better weather or allow extended family members to attend. Hence the noun funeralizing, a memorial service subsequent to a person's burial, often involving several preachers and lengthy testimonials. It was sometimes held annually for several years. Now, it's interesting here. My co-author wrote this definition, and he doesn't specify in these instances when it was held annually over the course of several years, whether it was for the same person or for different people. But it's interesting to think about how it would really keep those people in mind, because you would have the planning leading up to it and still thinking about them even months and years after they passed. Just another great example of connecting with the community. So for this, we have an interesting example from 1921. This is from an article called "A Funeralizing on Robbers Creek," which was printed in a magazine called New Outlook. It's written by Celia Cathcart Holton. And I will be honest, I don't know anything about this writer, but just based on this, it's pretty obvious that she was from outside the culture in the area. And honestly, it comes across as a bit judgmental, which kind of gets on my nerves, but I'll let you listen to it. Maybe she means well, but she writes, Peculiar to the Southern Mountains is the custom of funeralizing. When a man dies, he is buried with no ceremony whatever, with not even much mourning on the part of the relatives. Ministers are few and scattered, so there are no means of prompt communication with them and with interested friends at a distance, so only the demands of decency are complied with. After several members of the family have died, however, a pittance from the meager income is saved up for the purpose of hiring several ministers to conduct a funeral meeting, an elaborate event that more than atones for the apparent neglect. Just, she has some interesting wording there, doesn't she? But I think, you know, what we need to keep in mind as a modern audience, and perhaps I wish she would have been more aware of, or at least been a little bit more sensitive to in the way that she wrote this, is that many of these communities had to focus more on survival than on traditions. And, you know, if there were no resources for, say, embalming, and certainly not for putting together an elaborate service quickly, especially if it's happened suddenly and it's during harvest season or something like that. Another point I want to bring up here is it's important to keep in mind that just because someone doesn't witness, as she put it, mourning, it doesn't mean it's not happening. We know that folks in Appalachia can be pretty private and show only what they want to show to the outside world. I mean, that's the South in general, at least in my experience and my personal culture. It doesn't surprise me in the least that she didn't see any public displays of emotion. So the West Virginia Encyclopedia gives a little more context to the timing of these events. So here's their write-up. Because many preachers traveled extensive territories, funeralizing might be held only once a year, preferably on Memorial Day, and often in the graveyard rather than the church. I think this explains quite a bit, and it kind of gives us another angle into the reason why these things would be held so long after the person passed away. In a previous episode, I think I talked a little bit about how the teachers in an area would travel, and they might stay with like one family one week and another family another week. These are often the families of the students at the school where the teacher taught. And it seems that ministers and preachers had a similar system. They would be part of many different communities and spend a little bit of time in each one, sometimes staying with families, depending on the resources in a given community at the time. But also, so in that last citation, they use the word graveyard. But sometimes, instead of saying graveyard or cemetery, which were both very standard and still are, they would use the phrase burying ground. So we have some examples of this. The first one is from 1976 in the book Mountainese. We put a new grave rock at Uncle Penn's grave in the burying ground. And we also have an example of this going all the way back to 1817. So this is a word that has been in use for a long time. So this one is from Tennessee. It says, at this place, on Wednesday evening last, the 12th of a short and very severe illness, Thomas Jackson Esquire, a native of Pennsylvania and for many years a respected inhabitant of Hawkins County, Presbyterian burying ground. Related to this, the burial itself would often be called a burying. We have an entry for this in the dictionary, and here's our definition. The interment of a deceased person and the accompanying graveside ceremony, if one is held. Formerly, the funeral service could follow much later to accommodate family members and preachers and could last much of the day. So often, no service would be held at the burial, as we heard in the previous examples. Here's one more that gives some more detail. Again, from 1957, this one is written by Broaddus and comes from Kentucky. At a burying, there would be no sermon, but perhaps a few songs would be sung. The funeral, if any, would be held at a later date. So, when someone passed away, the community would almost always step in and take care of the family, make sure that things are taken care of. I think this is still the case in many smaller towns especially. And there's an interesting term that I ran across in my research for this episode. It's funeral pie. And the Encyclopedia of Appalachia has some good details about this. The offering of food acts as a measure of the deceased's place within the community. For instance, those who only knew the deceased or his or her family in passing may offer one small dish, such as a funeral pie, a generic term encompassing many types of simple pies often given to bereaved families. Individuals who knew the deceased well are likely to offer more elaborate or homemade dishes, cakes, cooked hams, or chickens, or to bring more than one dish over several days. In this way, the amount of food brought in both before and after the funeral can serve as a gauge for the popularity of the deceased. I don't really like to think of it as like a popularity contest, although I don't think they're inaccurate in saying that. So another tradition that goes hand in hand with taking care of the family in this way is the phrase set up with, which is something I actually grew up hearing from my grandparents when an elderly or sick relative might be near the end or if someone was desperately ill. So we have this phrase in the dictionary, and our definition is to join the family of a gravely ill or deceased person to provide steady comfort and assistance, especially with burial preparations, as in the phrases set up with the dead, set up with the sick. From 1937, we have an example. When anyone in the district is much sick, a crowd gathers to set up with him, cut the wood, and take care of things that need doing around the house. If it is plowing time, they pitch in and do the plowing for him. It is thought necessary for some outsider to stay around and be ready to carry the word in case the sick person dies. The sick person, if he thinks he is going to die, from time to time asks those sitting up to sing. He usually calls for a spiritual or religious song, such as Huck's Farewell or Can the Circle Be Unbroken? And then, again from 1974, we have another good description. Word of a death would spread rapidly in a neighborhood. Often, it was not a surprise because it was customary for neighbors to visit and set up with the sick and provide help and relief for the immediate family at such times. The custom of setting up with the corpse still persists, even though often in a modified form. Now, the dead may be kept overnight in a country church or at the funeral parlor instead of the home. Services may be held at either place. Formerly, neighbors and relatives gathered at the home of the dead person the night before burial, somewhat in the manner of the Irish wake. Whatever its origin, the practice by this time was an expression of respect for the dead, sympathy for the bereaved, and neighborliness. It was customary to feed the crowd there, just as it was customary to prepare feasts for funeral meetings and welcome whoever cared to eat. That example connects the tradition to an older Irish tradition, which seems pretty likely to me, considering so many people in Appalachia claim Irish heritage, myself being one of them, actually. So it's also interesting to me just to see how many different cultures around the world have such similar practices. To go back to Japan again, there's a similar custom of someone sitting with the body of the deceased the night before it's to be cremated. And you also have, on the other side of the world, things like sitting Shiva in the Jewish tradition. So I realize this has been kind of a heavy episode. But I hope that it gave a little more insight to some of the traditions surrounding death and funerals in Appalachia. I think the Appalachian traditions for these events were practiced with a lot of reverence and sensitivity in what is a really difficult place to live historically, and you see these communities coming together and maintaining these traditions as best they can and paying their respects to loved ones, despite the huge amount of obstacles, not the least of which being losing time to grow and harvest your own family's food. You know, they talk about work-life balance now, but I think this is just a whole other dimension. So that we don't end on too serious a note, though, with Halloween approaching, I hope you're all enjoying some booger tales or haint tales, as they refer to scary stories in the mountains. Or maybe your kids are getting ready for tic-tac night. or trick-or-treating, or beggar's night, as they call it in other parts of the country. I'm going to try to get an episode out again right around Halloween, because there's such a great tradition of scary stories and superstitions in Appalachia. And we know that Appalachia is home to some of the most haunted places in the country. So I'll work on that. But in the meantime, if you have any haint tales or ghost stories you'd like to share, please drop me a line. I would love to hear them. Speaking of messages, several weeks ago, one of you mentioned to me a great little story about being in elementary school and trying to figure out how to spell a word that was typed up W-H-O-L-L-O-G-O in the message. And I looked at it, and it really stumped me. I'm like, wait a second, I should know this. I even looked in our dictionary, and I'm like, no, it's not there. I don't remember ever seeing this. So honestly, I called up my mom, and I was like, what is this? I was trying to pronounce it, and I spelled it. And she got it immediately, and she started laughing, and she repeated it back to me. And suddenly, it clicked in my head. I knew exactly what it meant. A while ago. As in, when did you get here? A while ago. And I must have said that with that exact pronunciation when I was a child more times than I can count. It's so funny. I must have gotten it from my great-grandmother, who was a native of Appalachia, and she used to babysit me when I was very young. But when I was talking to my mom about this, as soon as I said it, it was like my brain and like muscles in my mouth just remembered exactly how to say it and how to use it. Such a funny experience. Like I said, language is amazing, isn't it? So thank you so much for sending that in. That was just a fun little story. I love stuff like that. Well, I will wrap up there for this episode. As always, you can find me at appalachian.dictionary@gmail.com, or you can leave a comment on YouTube or on one of the podcast servers. We are now on several different places, including Google Podcasts and iTunes, so I hope that makes it easier for y'all. And I will drop links to some of the books I mentioned in the show notes, so feel free to check those out. Until next time.